The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This series of California-based podcasts is brought to you in partnership with the Serica Initiative, our nonprofit program. The mission of the Serica Initiative is to produce independent educational and public awareness programming to make the U.S. and global public better informed about China. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original writing on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We are sure you'll agree, it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the University of California at Irvine, second stop on my whirlwind South to North California tour, my Nanxun. This is the Nanxun leg of it. It seems like every political movement has its anthems. The old Jacobites back in the 1740s had Charlie is My Darling. The American revolutionaries appropriated an old tune, Yankee Doodle, which was actually originally meant to mock the coarse and boorish colonials, and made it their own. The French revolutionaries, meanwhile, had the very rousing La Marseillaise. They win the prize for the best anthem. The American Civil War featured the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and of course, Dixie, and a song called The Battle Cry of Freedom, which was actually sung by both the blue and the gray. You had the Wobblies in the U.S. and a whole repertoire of great protest songs. The Depression, we had, you know, memorable tunes like Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? You had Woody Guthrie in the 40s with This Land Is Your Land, which was actually a great protest song. Doesn't sound like one anymore when we sing only the first two verses. Obviously, the likes of, you know, Which Side Are You On? Or We Shall Overcome? Or Give Peace a Chance? Or Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And then everything from Free Nelson Mandela to Fight the Power by Public Enemy. You get the idea. China has also produced a great many songs meant to stir the spirit. You had many revolutionary anthems and songs sung during the War of Resistance, including, of course, the March of the Volunteers, which became the People's Republic of China's national anthem. Red songs written during the Civil War or during the Maoist years were some of the first that I heard. The East is Red and Socialism is Good and Dai Hang Xin Kao Duo Shou. And more. Anyway, some of these have been revived and repurposed since, as we will discuss today. In 1989, along with Sui Jian's Nothing to My Name, the students also sang the Internationale, Guojige, which my old band, Tang Dynasty, did an arrangement of a couple of years later. And of course, during Bo Xilai's years in power in Chongqing, he revived many of these red songs and started something of a movement. In Hong Kong, we have heard a number of songs sung by the protesters, and speaking for myself at least, the effect is really quite moving. I don't think you have a soul if you aren't moved a little bit by this. There's Can You Hear the People Sing from the musical Les Miserables. There's Sing Hallelujah to the Lord. There's the song by the band Beyond called Boundless Oceans, Vast Skies. And of course, there is the unofficial anthem, Glory to Hong Kong. Well, today on Cynical, we are talking about music and protest, and I am delighted to have with me Jeff Wasserstrom, Chancellor's Professor of History at UC Irvine. Jeff is probably the one China academic who best embodies the very laudable effort to popularize specialist knowledge of China, to break it out of the old ivory tower and get it out there. To that end, he's written for many, many magazines and has written several highly accessible books on facets of China and its history. His latest book is called Vigil, Hong Kong on the Brink, which will be out in February, I believe. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, it's coming out February 11th.
Well, welcome to Cynical, man.
Hey, it's great to be on again.
Yeah, great to have you back. So, Jeff, let's start with a historical question. How far can you go back in Chinese history and find song or verse that's sort of tied to political movement?
So I'm not sure exactly how long songs go back, but certainly poetry goes back very far. And one of the places that it becomes important, you can go back further, but one place it's important is in the Boxer Uprising. And some of the only things we have left from the Boxers themselves are these doggerel verses, making fun of foreigners and their bizarre sexual habits and belief systems and things like that.
Fair's fair.
So it goes back that far.
Okay, well, the first songs that I am aware of probably come from the Republican period, when you have some both pro-Republican and then later on sort of pro-communist songs or anti-Japanese songs set to the same old song, which is a French classic, which can be sung in round, good old Frère Jacques. Tell us about Frère Jacques. You've actually written about Frère Jacques a bit.
So Frère Jacques is amazing because as far as I don't know of cases in, say, the U.S. protest movements where people put new lyrics to it, but it lends itself very nicely to criticizing sort of anything. There was an anti-imperialist version, sort of down with the powers, save China. It's done in Chinese, but that's basically what it translates as from the 1920s. And we have some of that preserved in a documentary film about China and revolution, where an old man talks about when he was young being taught this. Frère Jacques entered China through missionaries, and then it was put to anti-missionary, anti-imperialist meanings, and then it starts showing up in all sorts of different movements. There was even a Tiananmen version of it, which is the one thing I'll sing.
It's
Da Dao Yiga, Da Dao Yiga, Deng Xiaoping, Deng Xiaoping, Hai Yu Liu Meng, Hai Yu Liu Meng, Yang Sheng Kun, Yang Sheng Kun.
Doesn't even rhyme.
It doesn't quite rhyme, but Deng Xiaoping is nice. It sounds like a ringing bell, right?
Yeah. I remember the earlier version of that was something. I just remember the second half of it. I couldn't really, the old guy in that China in Revolution, which is an excellent, excellent documentary, he sings something like, something like that, right?
Yeah. There was also this weird version of it in the 1940s. There was a student protest where they were trying to go to Nanjing to present a petition to the government complaining about the Nationalist Party. And the Nationalist Party sort of blocked the train. And then they started singing to the tune of Frère Jacques, like, if the train won't start, we'll drive it. So, you know, you can do almost anything to it.
Wow. You were telling me earlier that you had brought this up with Carmen Hinton and asked her, you know, where did this come from? Why were they singing this foreign song? To which she replied,
so this was, there was a version of it during the Cultural Revolution that was anti-imperialist. And
of course there was.
Since Karma grew up in China during the Cultural Revolution, I was saying, like, you know, wasn't it ironic that you were singing this anti-imperialist song to a foreign tune? She goes, no, that's a Chinese folk song. She'd grown up learning it in, you know, in grade school and thinking it was Chinese.
Funny. So way back in ancient history, 17 years ago, it was July of 2002, you actually published a piece in the magazine The Nation about the role of music in the Tiananmen protests. It started with a little excerpt talking about Wu Kaixi, who, of course, was one of the more prominent student leaders in 89, and about how he thrilled an audience when he sang the song Northern Wolf by the Taiwan singer Qi Qin. Qi Qin is a guy whose career probably peaked in the 80s or the 90s. He was just a fantastically popular Taiwan singer and one of the first ones to get really popular. He's, you know, a rocker, long hair, the whole works. And Wu Kaixi had told the audience about how Qi Qin and Cui Jian were ultimately more important to the protest movement than the astrophysicist Fan Lizhi, who, you know, we those eggheads like us tend to sort of revere as one of the leaders of it. Your response to that, the reason that you liked that comment by Wu Kaixi was really interesting. But before we get to that, let's talk about this Qi Qin song, which was from 1985. He was, like I said, kind of a bad boy rocker guy. He was wildly popular when I was there in the late 80s and the 90s. Tell us about this song.
So it was, what was interesting is it was partly about this kind of evoking of the frontier and things. And Wu Kaixi himself had ties to Xinjiang.
He is a barbarian still. I know this because he's been on my show and the guy's crazy. He's great.
Yeah. 走在无垠的旷野中，凄厉的北风。
So he was, you know, he was, but what he was trying to get apart across was that a lot of what was driving people in the late 1980s was wanting more choices and a sort of sense of wanting to be freer to be individuals within a very collectivist kind of setting. And so things like freedom of expression were important, as well as not just in this kind of abstract political terms, but also just very kind of pragmatic lifestyle ones. They wanted to be free spirits and be able to act on it. And I was really aware of this most in 1986. I was in Shanghai as a student working on my dissertation on student protests of the past, of the pre-49 period, and the student protests began in 1986 there. And one of the things was Fang Lijie had given these speeches about democracy. But in Shanghai, at least, one of the things that motivated students to get involved was a rock concert by the beach band Jan and Dean, which had been one of the groups that had toured China. Wham had come the year before.
Right, 85, right.
And that was a big deal in Beijing. But, you know, Jan and Dean playing and some young people were really excited about being able to go to this concert. And then they got up to dance during the concert because that's what they thought you did. And some security guards told them to get back in their seats. And they just saw this as like symptomatic of this half opening to the West that was going on.
Right.
Half opening to the world. They wanted to be like people their age around the world, and they weren't being allowed to, but they were getting a taste of it. And I think the role of rock music at Tiananmen says a lot about that. It's like wanting to create an alternative space on the square where you could dance.
And the lyrics are interesting. I'll translate them really quickly. I am a wolf who comes from the north. It goes on to evoke like a lot of steppeland imagery, like you were saying, the biting cold and the empty grasslands. It's really wolf totem-y stuff. It evokes this kind of distinct form of northern Chinese masculinity, I feel like, real individualism.
I think there is a lot to that. And there was that in the movement, too. I mean, we do tend to idealize all these kinds of movements, but there was, of course, a sort of machismo to some of the protesters, definitely.
Oh, for sure. Like I mentioned, since we're staying in the rock idiom right now, let's talk about that the truly iconic song of the movement, which was Cui Jian Song Yi Wu Suo You. Tell us about that song.
So the lyrics are hard to, I mean, it doesn't have like, there are protest songs where that wear their protest element on their sleeve, you know, give peace a chance or something like that. And we should get around to John Lennon, by the way, because he's a connecting thread.
Absolutely.
To the Hong Kong protests. But there are other ones that are just subtler that evoke a kind of mood and a desire. And, you know, Nothing to My Name was sort of a feeling that a generation that wants to be able to claim something for itself. And the movement was its claim for that. It's saying, you know, and I love the scene that has that song playing and shows Sui Jian arriving at the square in the film The Gate of Heavenly Peace.
By Carmen Hinton, who we just
met. By Carmen Hinton, circling around, yeah.
So that song is actually, it's a love song, right? Or it's about a young man who's impoverished, obviously, I have nothing to my name, who is longing for a woman, and he asks her to go with him, and she just sort of laughs and says, you know, nothing to your name.
Yeah, won't you come and go with me? Is that so that it also has that kind of thing like, you know, won't you join me? And so you think about it like even though the lyrics aren't about protest, it has that kind of call to come join me in an effort, right? And so even if it's a love song, it can then be join me in this movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that somehow, I mean, that song probably came out in 86, I'm thinking. That was the
sounds
year,
about right.
86 or 87. Cui Jian was wildly popular. That was from his first album, which is called Rock and Roll on the New Long March. And it's interesting, though, that of all the songs was the one that really grabbed everyone. It's a fantastically good song. I think it's a bit ruined at the end by the double time. When it gets kind of like this, it has this kind of almost flippantly ska ending, but it has a real gravitas through most of the song, right?
Yeah, and it's still, I mean, this is where, you know, we can analyze these things, but at some point it's either got to grab you as a song or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And this one does grab you.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear it now and I still get shivers.
我曾经问过不休，你何时跟我走，可你却总是笑我一无所有。我要给你我的追求，
I'm curious what you made of Tang Dynasty's version of the Internationale. I've been really amused at the way people have interpreted that and some of our other songs. Really amused often at the way that people imputed political motive or political intent to not just that or not just our songs, but to Chinese rock more generally back then. What did you make of that when you heard it? What did you imagine our intent was?
So it's really interesting because, you know, during the Tiananmen movement, there was singing of the Internationale, but it was sung straight. And the idea was sort of like, if you really listen to the lyrics of this, aren't we representing this on the square as right. much as or more than you are as the government? So that's one thing you can do with a kind of official song. You can like claim it as your own. But the other thing you can do is you can play with it. You can mock it, or you can sort of say, I'm not taking this as seriously as you want me to take it. And so I, of course, when I heard, you know, the Tang Dynasty version, the first thing I thought of was Jimi Hendrix with the Star Spangled Banner.
Uh-huh.
And mixing it around, you know, and there were other versions of this. I knew, you know, growing up, there were times when people, you know, I grew up during the, I was young, but during the anti-war movement and things like that. And there were times when people would put new mocking lyrics to an official song.
Right.
Like, you're a grand old flag became you're a grand old rag, you know.
Right, right, right.
Things like that.
But my country's sick of me.
Yeah.
I'm going to Germany.
All of that. Yeah. But with the Hendrix thing, it was more like, let's take something that's sacred and show that it's actually something you can play with. Mm. So that's how I thought of the Internationale.
We played it really straight, though. I mean, didn't yeah. change a thing, didn't Dude. Change any of the lyrics. The melody stayed exactly the same. It was just the instrumentation.
Just the instruments. Just
rocked it
just
up.
Just the instruments. Yeah. Well, that'll change it.
One of these days, I'm going to dig out of a box of tapes a recording of the original demo for that we recorded in 91. And I haven't heard it forever, but I think it was a lot better. It was the one that ended up on the recording. It has, you know, this sort of Soviet style choir singing on it at one point. It's kind of a little bit cheesy and not as raw and punky as the original one was.
Well, I've only heard the one version.
Yeah,
and I love it. So
I will have to
share
that with
you. I'll look forward to hearing the other one.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Sing Red movement that Bo Xilai pushed in the period roughly from 2010 to 2012. What's your take on that? What was his thinking and what was the impact of his appropriation of these old Cultural Revolution era songs?
So I think, you know, it's part of this larger reclaiming of elements of the Mao era. And I think it's, you know, it's complicated in many ways. I mean, that one of the things is music can operate at a bunch of different levels. At some level, the songs that you know when you're a teenager just have a special effect on you through the rest of your life. I mean, I know it now. When I hear a song come on the radio that was something I dismissed as just, or it's not on the radio now, but when I hear a snatch of a song that I dismissed as, you know, shallow pop music that I didn't really care about when I was 16, I hear that now and I get a kind of nostalgia for it, even if it was a song I didn't like. And so there is a way that people, even people who are totally scarred by the Cultural Revolution, who were of an age when that was the music they were singing, it can appeal to them at that level. So the Red Song movement could evoke a kind of nostalgia just for people, even if they suffered during that period, it's hearing the old songs again. But there was also a sense of that there's been in China for many people for now quite a while, of a sense of something missing, of just
that spiritual vacuum.
There's a spiritual vacuum that can lead people to different kind of religions, but it can also lead people to looking for something that was lost from an age
where, sure,
yeah, it was just more to believe in. So I think it operates at those multiple levels.
Yeah, I think that's a very good analysis of it. And some of those songs are really damned stirring. They're really, 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 for me, there are a couple that just do it to me completely. One is the song of the gorillas. Do you know this one? Mm-hmm. 游击队之歌?
I probably know it, but I don't know offhand, yeah.
我们都是神枪手,每一个子弹像一个敌人,我们都是飞行军,哪怕它山高水又深,在那秘密的树林里... Anyway, I can't remember all the lyrics, but that one was... We were toward the end of Tang Dynasty's career, we were trying to work up a really cool little metal version of that, but...
cool.
Yeah, it would have been fun. But yeah, Sing Red movement. I mean, it's... curious, I mean, what would have happened, I wonder, you know, if Bo Xilai had emerged on top, would it be a more overt invocation of the Mao cult than we're seeing now, or less?
We see in Xi Jinping, initially, there was the thought that he was the repudiation of everything that Bo Xilai was about, because they were competitors. But actually, you see a similar effort to fill whatever that hole is, and with some kinds of Mao evocations. In his case, it's evoked through a book that everybody's supposed to be paying attention to reading, which is different from, I guess if I had to choose between
take the song,
the Xi Jinping book or the Bo Xilai songs, I would take the songs.
Yeah, not a tough choice. You mentioned John Lennon just now, and I think we do need to bring him up here. And the idea of rock music and politics, and just to bring it back to what I was talking about earlier, how it always sort of... when I would be asked, as I was routinely asked about Tang Dynasty's music and what the political content of it was, my instinct back then was to say, I mean, this is sort of the official line, and this is not just me, but all the other guys in the band. It was like, you know what? China is not the United States, and this is not the 1960s, and there's the tendency to sort of, you know, insist that you can find a counterpart to everything. That's wrong. And the idea that our music necessarily contains some sort of political motive to it, you know, it seems absurd. I remember reading some work by some scholar who I've confronted about it. He hasn't answered me ever, but he had written that that we were sort of this selling this idea of a critique of current CCP by evoking a glorious bygone age. That wasn't it at all, actually. In fact, I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but the truth of the meaning of the name of the band and what it was supposed to evoke was, it was almost a sort of a celebration of reform and opening. It was this idea that the Tang was great precisely because it was open and cosmopolitan. That was its strength. And maybe today we're in another period where openness, unembarrassed borrowing from outside, and would lead once again to greatness. Of course, the selfish motive was that we needed to package it in a way that it would simultaneously appear to be something familiar, that it would sort of convey this idea subliminally, but it would be, you know, we were sneaking something decidedly foreign into a Chinese audience. But the idea that, you know, rock music was inherently the music of protest, for some reason, I rebelled against that. I less so today. I definitely, I think that, of course, it had, you know, some of that adolescent angst and rage in it. I mean, it had to, but I don't know what it was.
I think it's interesting that sometimes we associate certain genres with kinds of politics. We associate rock music with rebellion, but of course, there were efforts to tame rock music, and there can be pro-government rock music in any setting. And you can actually find also genres that seem... that seem incredibly tame, that can be put to radical uses. So
sure.
In the Hong Kong protests, some of the, you know, canto pop singers have become Denise Ho being the main
most obvious example.
Be very, yeah. When you, if you listen to some of her songs, you don't think, oh, okay, this is somebody who's going to be at the front of a protest movement.
Right.
It can be. Hymns can take on political meanings or totally non-political meanings.
Sing Hallelujah to My Lord. Yeah.
Exactly. It's there. And there have been efforts to use rap music to promote Xi Jinping's policies. So, you know, if that can happen, it's wrong to mistake genres for politics. You know, different things can be fed into them. You can have subversive country music, and you can have very conservative country music. So the question is sort of how it operates in certain places. And you could have things, so early in the Beatles, there were things that were rebellious about the fact they were doing what they were doing.
Right.
But there really weren't protest songs, sort of obviously. John Lennon.
But it was transgressive in its day.
Right. I mean, transgressive is a good way to put it. You
right,
know?
Right, right.
You can think of transgressive without being necessarily obviously overtly political.
Right. And that's what Sui Jian was exactly. all about, right?
I mean, exactly. And you can have something that's transgressive, but people miss it, which was the case famously in the U.S. with Bruce
Born in the USA.
Born in the USA.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Right, right, right.
And it's sort of a little bit too subtle. But I think John Lennon, at a certain point, there's no ambiguity to give peace a chance.
Right.
And his song that was what I was thinking of with the connecting thread was Imagine. In 2014, when the Hong Kong protests were at a much more optimistic and hopeful moment, one of the banners when I went over during the Umbrella Movement that caught my eye at first was one that was saying, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of timeless appeal to that kind of that song, which you can imagine people at 18 and all kinds of times and places being captured by.
Ironically, now they're called Lennon Walls, and that sentiment is hardly to be found.
So the Lennon Wall, the Lennon Wall connection, so people weren't singing. I didn't hear anybody sing Imagine, but there was that lyric from Imagine, and there was the first Lennon Wall in Hong Kong
right.
in 2014. The Lennon Wall itself, the idea of a Lennon Wall came from Prague. Prague in the early 80s, after John Lennon's assassination, some people in Prague who identified with John Lennon as a kind of a radical voice, but somebody who was kind of outside of the Cold War. And they put up, they painted sort of graffiti in colorful ways on a wall in Prague. And that was the Lennon Wall. So then in Hong Kong in 2014, they put up this thing that they called a Lennon Wall that was inspired in part by that, but it immediately got local twists. One thing is when these things happen, whether it's a song like Farajaka or a protest tactic, it gets localized when
right.
it travels. So in Hong Kong, unlike in Prague, the Lennon Wall was largely post-it notes, colorful post-it notes, which individual people in Hong Kong wrote things out at.
Right. You'd expect that from an island of white collar workers.
Exactly, right? Exactly. It was totally localized and cosmopolitan at the same time.
Yes, yes. Speaking of Lenin, I'm speaking of Prague. There's another Czech-China connection that's musical as well. Charter 77 was really sort of built on the backs of this band called Plastic People, right? That was popular in the mid-70s in the Czech Republic. And I guess it was Czechoslovakia still then. And it's interesting that that was very much the touchstone for a lot of the early sort of more political Chinese rockers. And again, that led to Charter 77, which was echoed in Charter 08 in China.
And Sui Jian recorded an album, The Power of the Powerless.
Exactly, which
was
the name
Havel,
of a Václav Havel
another
book,
connection. Right? So it's very interesting, these flows back and forth.
Indeed. Indeed, there is. So let's move on and talk more directly about Hong Kong. Hong Kong, you know, you've written a book about, and we'll ask you to talk a little bit about that, but there's a long history of protest there. Have songs played a role in earlier protests that you're aware of in Hong Kong?
Well, the 2014 is the first moment that I really paid attention to it.
Uh-huh.
There were songs before, but those songs and the song that I was intrigued by in part because of this Farajaka obsession. So there's a song tied to France that was important. Do You Hear the People Sing?
Of course, yeah.
And what's really interesting is, so that was
via Broadway.
So via Broadway. So you can take it back to, you know, rebelliousness in France in the 19th century. You can take it forward to Broadway and then it comes over. And, you know, it's a kind of generic, you know, can you hear the people sing? It's calling on the authorities to pay attention to what the people are saying.
Sure.
But there's a wonderful poet in and translator and editor and activist in Hong Kong, Tammy Ho, who wrote a sort of memoir piece about the umbrella movement and how it was dividing her family and other things like that. But one thing she did was take apart the lyrics to this song from Les Miserables. And she said that in the Cantonese version, the meaning of it has changed quite distinctively. Hmm. When you sing a song in a different language, you have a lot of freedom with the, you have to have be free with the translation because you have to have it fit the rhythm,
sure,
the meter, and the rhyme. And in Cantonese, it becomes, have you spoken out yet? Or who has not
really
spoken out yet? So it's actually calling on people to come and go with me if we want to circle back. It's saying, join us here, rather than necessarily saying to the government, why aren't you listening? It's saying, if you love, I mean, to really interpret it a bit further, if you love this place, why aren't you on the streets now? So it's a quite different, and people sang it both in English and in Cantonese, the two languages of Hong Kong.
Right. What about the lyrics to what's become the most famous of the anthems, Glory to Hong Kong? What do you know about the history of that song, who wrote it and who composed the music and so forth?
So mostly what I know about the song comes largely from the China Heritage website,
yeah,
that
Jeremy Barme
runs. And there are different versions of it on there, and you can get the whole background. I mean, what's interesting to me about it, a couple of things. One is that I was just in Hong Kong on December 8th for this massive peaceful march,
right,
one of the most recent one. On the date, by the way, December 8th, the anniversary of John Lennon's assassination.
Ah.
Nobody was paying attention to except me and my Twitter feed. And I saw those two things and I thought that was so interesting because John Lennon had this connection to the earlier Hong Kong protest. But what was interesting on December 8th this year was that was the only song I heard. That it's really, there were a variety of songs that were kind of, during the umbrella movement, Beyond song was important, the Les Miserables song was important, there were different ones. And early in this year's movement, the Hallelujah to My Lord the variety of ones were important. But on December 8th, the Glory to Hong Kong was the only one that people were singing. So it really had achieved this defining the community anthem status.
Mm.
And there were, it's both the song itself, and there have been some beautiful videos made of it, including one of an orchestra playing it with gas masks. And this was circulating online. So there's been a lot of play with it itself. But the lyrics, I mean, it has a rousing feel. It has an appeal to, it has an appeal to, lack of a better word, patriotism, whether you think of that to, you know, a country or to a community. It's really calling for, it's an expression of attachment, intense attachment.
Let's give it a quick listen. So Jeff, I mean, what strikes me about it musically is that it's in a meter that is very deliberately evocative of two songs that we've already mentioned. One is the Marseillaise, and the other is that Broadway song from Les Mis, you know, Do You Hear the People Sing? It seems like it's got to be intentional. It's in that 6-8 time, it's in the same basic tempo, and it has that sort of anthemic grandiosity to it.
Yeah, I agree totally. I think musically that's what's going on.
Is it then, is it supposed to, do you reckon it to be a pro-independence anthem?
So I think, I mean, so the whole notion of independence gets so wrapped up. I mean, the way I like to think about this, and this is where I'll get sort of, I'll go academic on it a little bit, let's say. So Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities is the most influential text on nationalism that's come out of the academy.
Right.
But what he says is, what's interesting about nations, he says, is, and well, he says that every community is an imagined one, larger than a small village where everybody knows everybody else. When you talk about being attached to a city, you don't know the other people in that city. If you say, I love New York, or you say, I'm proud to be an Angeleno, you're talking about a connection to all sorts of people that you've never come into contact with.
Right.
So the nation is the ultimate example of this on a large scale. And imagined communities has been interpreted as just being about nations. And he says the thing about the way we imagine nations is we imagine them as a family writ large, the metaphors of kinship, and we imagine them as home.
Right.
But he says other communities are imagined communities too that you feel an attachment to. So actually what he just said about imagining it as a family writ large and as home is something people also feel about cities, even when they're part of countries. So I guess this is, you know, the hedging of it is that definitely when people take to the streets now, they're taking to the streets out of love of Hong Kong as a specific political community. Whether they can imagine that community being part somehow of a country, some probably still can, but they want it to be a special part of it. Others want it to be its own thing.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot because at the moment I feel very, very alienated from the United States as a country, but I still feel very attached to California. So I've taken to sometimes talking about living in the special administrative region of California.
Separatism.
And, you know, and I was at a protest in Hong Kong as an observer in 2016, and then I came back here, and a few weeks later I was at the Women's March in LA, and I thought about this kind of parallel of saying that, like, I'm here because I don't like what the old men in the Capitol are doing, and I don't want them to tell me how to be. And so it was a bit like being in an SAR. It was different, though, because the mayor of Los Angeles turned out to speak to us. And, you know, so it's quite different.
Kerry is not going
to
do that.
But I think if we want to cheat on this, is it can work. It certainly works if you're pro-independence. I think if you feel pro-independence and you hear Glory to Hong Kong, it'll stir your heart. But you could be not pro-independence, just really love Hong Kong and want it to be itself, even if it's part of a larger country, and also like that song.
So I actually went and I found what seems like an official translation, an authorized official version of in English, though. And I wouldn't presume to say that the Chinese as written, you know, in Mandarin would be the same as a Cantonese speaker would understand it. So I don't want to attempt any of my own translation here. But the official English translation reads, "In angst, tears are shed o'er this land. With rage, fears are crushed. In arms we stand. We rise undefiled. Our voice shall never die. As we yearn, our freedom nighs." I'm not sure what nighs is.
I'm not sure that either.
Yeah. It's like grows nigh, I suppose. "With eyes blinded, long it comes the night. In faith, banners high, we pledge to fight. Our flesh sacrificed, our blood shall write this song. Free this land, stand with Hong Kong." Obviously, there's a lot that was, you know, forced into rhyme here. "Stars will fall and darkness fills the air. Storms will break, bedazzled by our gallant flares. We shall strike this perilous night, determined to fight with hope, with song, with dignity. Glory enshrined, break our chains, hold our lines. Freedom shall rise, revolution of our time. Liberty thrives, rights divine, in our unending strides. Glory be to thee, Hong Kong." So, I mean, without going into a deep exegesis of it, there are lines in there that are clearly evocative of other pieces of text in other songs. There's you know, the flares, the you know, which is the rocket's red glare, sort of. There's this breaking of chains, which is ironically, you know, very much like most of the communist anthems that you'll actually hear.
Good point.
Right. A lot of it makes reference to other sort of things that are already mimetic within the Hong Kong protest tradition. Things like,
well, the front lines and, you know.
Well, right. But there was obviously Stand with Hong Kong was part of it. But there was also the sort of biblical feel of it, which is the hymnal kind of feel to it, too, which is evocative of the singing of the Hallelujah.
Right. And there is a, you know, there have been a fair number of the leaders of the Hong Kong movement at different points. Now it's fairly leaderless, but in the earlier iterations, some of the leaders have been Christian. And if Joshua Wong, Christianity Matters, two of the organizers of the Occupy movement of the older generation, one was a reverend and the other, Benny Tai, talks a lot about faith.
Right.
And there is that kind of that element to it as well. It wasn't just Hallelujah.
So very interesting. I think I'd love to see somebody actually offer a direct translation from Cantonese of it. I'd like to understand better what it actually says and how that holds up against the English translation that they have.
Just to mention, Sebastian Vague is somebody who's written some of the best stuff about the symbolism of the Umbrella Movement, and now he's working on 2019.
Oh, great.
And he's written about songs in the Umbrella Movement, so he'll be the one.
I will reach out to him. Yeah. Sebastian, if you're listening, give me a shout. So what was the impact of this song, Glory to Hong Kong? How much did it energize the movement? Did it really sort of give it a new life and a new focus? I mean, my sense just watching it from the distance was that it was quite impactful, that it really did make the splash that I think its composers obviously thought that it were hoping that it would.
Yeah, I think it did. It had a real impact. I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about studying social movements is there always are unpredictable moments that things happen. There are events that happen that take things to a different level. There can be things that if they didn't exist, the whole arc would be different. In 1989, I think the protest would have been very different if People's Daily hadn't come out with an editorial denouncing the protesters and describing them as rioters. And that gave people something to focus on. That's a kind of negative thing. And in 1989, there were certain things. The Goddess of Democracy was just something that energized people.
In 89, they had a surfeit of powerful symbols,
right,
available to them.
In the Hong Kong movement, during the Umbrella Movement, it was energized by the use of tear gas by the authorities. It was also energized
by the eponymous umbrella.
The umbrella.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the things that this movement was lacking, and actually is still lacking, is a clearly identified name. For a while, people were suggesting maybe it could be the hard hat revolution.
The water revolution.
Or the helmet revolution or the bee water revolution. But nothing's completely caught. I think the bee water symbol was one of the things, the idea of that, of flexible tactics, a different way of being. But I think the song has been a drawing together thing that I hadn't thought about this way. But
the glorious revolution's already taken.
It's already taken, so you can't call it that. But having something that people can kind of agree on, that this speaks to what we're about. And there still isn't. There still isn't a name. It's really interesting.
I think Jamil Anderlini was one who suggested the water revolution. I'm surprised that hasn't taken on as much sort of permanence as I would have expected. I thought that once that had escaped his lips, that was it. I mean,
yeah. Well, certainly the term "be water" has resonated, and I think it's interesting. It's one of the things that has been exportable. That even if the Hong Kong movement fails at everything it's trying to do locally, it's already made contributions to the kind of global repertoire of protest. We've seen it there. The idea of occupying an airport just wasn't something that really happened. And now it's happened in some other places. Places like Catalonia, they're looking at Hong Kong, looking to Hong Kong. And the Hong Kong movement, of course, have always been looking to other places.
That's right.
In 2014, for young Hong Kong protesters, the Sunflower events in Taiwan were very important. And of course, before it was called the Umbrella Movement or Umbrella Revolution, it was called the Occupy Movement.
Right.
And that was inspired partly by people who were looking to places like Occupy Wall Street.
That's great. Tell me about this book you're working on right now, Vigil, Hong Kong on the Brink. It's due out in February, and I imagine we'll have you back on the show when it comes out and we can talk about it. But
that'd be great.
Give us a preview.
So I started writing it. I signed up to do it early this year. And actually, the idea, it's for the series called Columbia Global Reports, which puts out very short books on pressing issues of the moment, often by journalists. There's one in the works by Darren Byler, who's sub-China, a sub-China writer, is going to be on Xinjiang. And the idea is to do the kind of long-form writing by journalists that's harder to get into magazines now, or to have academics writing in a kind of accessible reportage mode. But when I signed on to do it at the beginning of 2019, my idea was it would largely be the sort of arc from the handover and before the handover up through the umbrella movement, and then the kind of a mood of despair that had taken hold, and largely a kind of feeling that the movement, the space for protest was shrinking, yeah. And the desire maybe even was shrinking, that maybe there was just a sense of being beaten down. And of course, then with June, I thought I was going to go to Hong Kong, I knew, for the 30th anniversary of the June 4th massacre vigil. And Hong Kong and Macau are the only two parts of the PRC where you can publicly commemorate the massacre of 1989. And Hong Kong's the only place where a really large-scale vigil takes place.
Right.
So I was going to go there for the vigil, which I've never attended, and that would kind of make the endpoint. And it would make an endpoint with me wondering if 1 year, 5 years from now, you would still be able to commemorate it, or if the distance between Hong Kong and mainland cities would have shrunk so much that you couldn't do that. And then, of course, things took a radically different turn.
When the word vigil no longer means, right.
And vigil, so vigil had this other sense of sort of sitting vigil over an endangered loved one. And so for Hong Kong, vigil that way. But actually now, when I was just in Hong Kong, though this won't be in the book because I used October 1st as a stopping point for the book.
Yeah.
I wrote it very quickly. And I thought October 1st was a good end point, even though the movement was continuing. Because October 1st, there was the giant planned celebration in Beijing to mark 70 years of the PRC. And at the same time, there was yet another protest in Hong Kong challenging that. And there was the first use of live ammunition by the police. So that seemed to be an end point. But things have happened since then. And when I was just there last week, one of the last things I saw was a vigil of sorts organized by high school students. Very moving. Several hundred high school students were there, and it began with a moment of silence, in part for there hasn't been any kind of massacre, though some people have worried about it. But there have been some people have died, either suicides or one student who
fell off of a parking garage,
and that's interpreted as having been sort of driven to his death by tear gas and by the police. At least that's how it's understood by a lot of the students there. And so this was a moment of silence for him, and also for the others who've been harmed or died during the movement. So it was a very kind of vigil-like moment. But the book is a short one. It's about 20,000 words. So it's very short, about 100 pages.
It's a New Yorker article.
Yeah, exactly. Lightly footnoted, largely. And it tries to weave in, it has a bit about music, but it also brings in films and novels and the ways in which different kinds of artistic expression serve as expression or templates for action. And I do what I think I can bring to it. I've been going to Hong Kong since the mid-1980s, and I bring in my experiences with that. And I observe some of the umbrella movement, and I've observed different events since then. But what I think I bring to the table that's different is a sense of interesting comparisons and what I call imperfect analogies. There's no perfect analogy for what's going on there. It's not Umbrella 2.0. The protesters want to make it different from what was there in 2014. It's not Tiananmen 2.0 either, for all sorts of reasons. But there are, I think, parallels that if you realize they're flawed can help us understand. One of the parallels I bring in is Shanghai before 1949, the kinds of protests that took part there, the kind of repression mm-hmm. took place there. The local authorities are doing some things the Nationalist Party would understand, including working with gangsters to try to intimidate protesters. That was something that was done by the Kuomintang before sure. it was done by others. There's also some ways in which the dilemma that people are facing in Hong Kong now, do I stay? Do I leave? Will this still be a place 10 years down the line that I can make the kind of life I lead if, say, you're a cosmopolitan-minded intellectual or filmmaker or writer? Those were questions people were asking themselves in Shanghai in the 1940s. So there is sort of parallels there. But the other parallel I bring in that I think is very useful in thinking about Carrie Lam's position and the Hong Kong authorities, where they have to look to Beijing for guidance on what to do, but they're also trying to present themselves as separate. It reminds me a lot of the situations that, cycling back to the Czechoslovakia and other places, the satellite states within the Soviet Empire were in a sort of similar position. In Poland in 1981, Solidarity had a giant movement, and then it was suppressed locally by the Polish authorities, who were also looking to Moscow for what would happen. And in the past, Moscow had brought in troops to suppress things when things got out of hand, but they wanted to handle it locally.
And yeah, there are,
in 1981, they did. So those are the kinds of parallels. They're not perfect, and you can't push them too far, but I think they can get us out of the box of thinking, even though what's happening in Hong Kong is unique and of this moment, it's also something that can be understood in some ways through comparison and history.
Well, Jeff, your last book was all about historical analogies. I guess you haven't gotten it all out of your system
just yet. It's how my mind works. I just find comparisons just so interesting.
Yeah, yeah, they really are. Looking around the world right now, there are street revolutions breaking out in quite a number of geographies, everything from Santiago, Chile. They actually had to move COP25 all to Madrid because of that. There's too many places right now to even name. Do you think that that Hong Kong is of a piece with these? Do you think that there's been inspiration traveling in either direction from these? Or do you think that these are quite different in character because most of these that are happening around the world are sort of, I think, can be understood as the revolt against neoliberalism, whereas Hong Kong maybe is different? What's your take on that?
So my take on this, you know, again, historically, is to think that, in fact, you have both things going on in years of when it seems that there are protests around the world. They're both connecting threads and things that are different, but in part, something seems to be in the air.
Sure. Yeah.
And people can borrow a tactic from another place that has nothing to do with the cause of the other place. So this was true in 89, there were protests in China, of course, and in Eastern Europe. And in some ways, they were very different, even though we thought of them as being more similar because they were all in Communist Party-run places. But the Chinese protests were about getting the Communist Party to live up to its own ideals. The protests in parts of Eastern Europe were just sick of the Communist Party rule. And in parts of Eastern Europe, Communist Party rule was seen as an external imposition.
Right.
In China, it was seen as an internal thing.
Force, right.
So, and I think when we look back other places, in 1919, 100 years ago, was a year when there were protests around the world in Korea, in China, in India, in Egypt, all of which were anti-colonial in some way or another. It was also when the Seattle General Strike, if you go back to this. And the Seattle General Strike was very different, but in Shanghai, during the May 4th movement, there was a general strike. So, you know, you have some things where maybe some of the tactics are the same, but the causes are different. Now, at the moment, before the Hong Kong protests, there were the Yellow Vests.
Sure.
Which were also flexible protests, leaderless protests, blocking of roads. Some of that carries over, and yet other things about them are radically different.
Right.
Catalonia may have some things that you could connect up to Hong Kong, Chile, much less.
Right.
We had a very interesting event here on, we call them pop-up panels that we do when we're trying to get, rather than the typical academic thing is you plan something at a university and it takes 6 months or a year to do it. We try to do it instantly. And we did one bringing together Chile, Haiti, another place where people are in the streets, and Lebanon, and put these together and tried to look at what was similar, what was different. And you find some shared characteristics even when there are also differences. This is another place where I think the imperfect analogies idea it's not just historical analogies. Also, when things are happening simultaneously, they're not going to be the same. But if there's an awareness of each other, there's going to be some
transmission
flow
of ideas and stuff. Yeah.
The Les Miserables song we've been talking about was sung by South Korean protesters during the Candlelight Revolution. So, you know, you can see different things. You can sing the same song in a different context. You can use the same tactic.
Indeed. So I look forward to talking to you about the book when you are on the East Coast on your tour. Let's do an event together.
It'd be great.
That'll be a lot of fun. Jeff, it's been great having you on. Let's move on to our recommendations section. But first, let me remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best thing that you can do to support our work is to subscribe to SupChina's daily newsletter. This thing is really chock full of great reads on China, delivered to your inbox every day. Every weekday, anyway. Jeremy and Lucas and Jiayun and Anthony are working really, really hard to bring you this product. It's terrific value for money. So sign up, spread the word, and let's move on to recommendations. Jeff, what do you have for us, man?
So
let's stay with music.
Yeah, let's stay with music. Well, I mean, there's this book by Linda Javan, The Monkey and the Dragon, which goes back to 1989, which is really, it's a wonderful read. And I don't think, and it actually I talk about in the Nation piece that you mentioned. But the book that I would give as a recommendation going outside of China but sticking with music is 33 Revolutions Per Minute by The Guardian's music critic, Dorian Linsky, who's actually shares, I've never met him, but he shares two of my obsessions. One is protest songs. The other is George Orwell. He just wrote a book, Ministry of Truth, about 1984. But in 33 Revolutions Per Minute, he gives these wonderful essays about a series of protest songs, the derivation, where they came from, the impact they had. And when I read it, I thought what was missing was a chapter about Sui Jian's Nothing to My Name, which, you know, if I were going to critique the book, that's what would do it. But it's wonderful to dip into.
Yeah, that's great. I'm definitely going to check that book out. I'm just going to recommend a couple of things that have been on pretty steady rotation for me. It's just become one of my favorite albums, period. I think there's just not a weak moment on it. It's the Dire Straits album, Making Movies, which is just perfect. You know, it's one, it starts with Tunnel of Love, and it's got Romeo and Juliet on it, and Skate Away and Espresso Love. Just a lot of the songs that, you know and love, but the recording quality is phenomenal, and Knopfler is just amazing. He's just what a great craftsman he's always been. True. And I mean, I listened to a lot of Dire Straits albums, and really, this is the one. This is them at their peak. Another I want to recommend is something I've been listening to a lot recently, just because I'm reconnecting with my old college buddies, and something we listen to constantly in various mental states in the 80s. It's one of the solo albums by Genesis's old guitarist, Steve Hackett. It's called Voyage of the Acolyte. And to me, it's pretty much it's what progressive rock was supposed to be. I mean, it has just all of everything that you want from it. Just the beauty, the transcendent beauty, that kind of an overarching kind of symphonic concept theme running across it, but it's nothing on the nose. And there's this sort of mysticism to it. And, I love Hackett's playing. He's one of the guitarists who most influenced me, growing up. And so Voyage of the Acolyte by Steve Hackett. Anyway, Jeff, man, what a pleasure hanging out and talking music and politics with you.
Nothing better than talking about protests, talking about music.
That's right.
What a pleasure.
Man. Okay. We'll talk to you again soon. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email, really do, at seneca@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out all the other podcasts in our network, which is growing, and watch this space for announcements for new network shows, which are coming soon. Thanks very much for listening. We will see you next week, and take care.